This lecture is on the geologic record, and we'll go ahead and start with it. I think it's quarter till now. This first picture is a picture of the Grand Canyon. You can see the horizontal layers all the way down a mile deep into the Grand Canyon, and you notice the top also is very, very flat, as are all the layers that are horizontally pancaked there, and there's very little unevenness. They're all like knife blades as far as separation of one layer from the next. And then you see these little buttes off in the distance, and we'll talk a little bit about them as well. Features of the geologic column. General features. The geologic column is made of sedimentary layers that have turned to rock. The layers are generally very flat and even relative to each other, as in that first picture. These layers are generally found all over the globe. Some areas of the world have few layers or missing layers, completely missing layers, and some areas have most, if not all, of the layers, a full column. The column is found on mountains, such as the Swiss Alps, Mount Everest, the Rockies, Himalayas, Appalachians, and other mountain ranges, and is popularly thought to be a record of millions and even billions of years of Earth's history. And the geologic record contains fossils as well. So there's names to the layers, and then there's certain key index fossils as well that are associated with the layers, and we'll talk about those more in the fossil record section. So, question is, what would you expect an old geologic column to look like if the geologic record is truly representative of millions and billions of years of Earth's history? You'd kind of expect the first layers a long, long time ago to be laid down all flat. You know, you get these sediments, they're laid down flat, and then they get uplifted a little bit and they're eroded. There's some erosion going on. And then you got more layers laid on top, and they fill in these little gaps. And then you get more erosion and more layering as you go on over time. And so I would expect something to look like kind of like this over millions and billions of years. The geologic columns should look more like that. So what does, I mean, here's, you know, there's the tops of dendritic looks to erosion of mountain ranges, and it's pretty random, a dendritic or tree-like pattern to the whole type of erosion that we generally see. Here you see on the surface of these rocks an unevenness of erosion, and yet you see the layers that were previously laid down, there's no evidence of prior erosion. There is no erosion, evidently, that happened for millions and billions of years until the very top. And then they got some erosion happening significantly. And here is layers of the Grand Canyon. This is the Grand Canyon in schematic cross-section. And then the Grand Canyon is actually uplifted a bit. It makes a dome-like structure. And then it's cut down like this in this very sharp V-shaped form. And then these layers here are flat relative to each other, not really eroded except for flatly, because see this grand staircase, these layers here? These layers once extended all over the Grand Canyon, but they have since been washed away. See these longitudinal staircase levels where they've been washed away? But they've been washed away flatly, see, over the Grand Canyon? It's a nice flat erosion, not the dendritic type of erosion that we usually see today. It's kind of sheet-like or flat erosion. And my question is, how do you do that slowly? And here you see the contact zone. Here's a Coconino shale or a sandstone over the Hermit Shale in the Grand Canyon. And you see the line between them is really flat, except where there's these sharp cracks in the underlying Hermit Shale that are filled with pure Coconino sandstone. And my question is, how do you get a crack forming over millions of years without any contaminants? The only thing it's filled by is the overlying sediment, pure Coconino sandstone. No debris, no other type of contaminant going on, pure Coconino sandstone. How does that happen over millions of years of time? And here you see the same sort of thing. Here's the Coconino sandstone on the bottom, and you see the angle here of the layers, and then it got shaved off flatly, and then you got the toro weep formation on the top, flatly deposited as thin as a razor blade between the two layers. How do you shave something off so flatly? Slowly, is the question, and non-catastrophically. This happened over millions of years. This got shaved off nice and flatly, and then this layer got deposited on top. nice and slowly.
Rapid deposition of flood deposits from tidal action means there was little time for erosion to occur between successive layers. On the long time scale envisioned by evolutionary theory, there should be considerable evidence found of erosion and infilling by successive geologic formations during the weathering expected over millions of years. The geological layers of the Grand Canyon are remarkable in showing little or no evidence of erosion between different layers. Instead, we see pancake layering, very much consistent with the rapid deposition envisioned by the flood model. Erosion did not occur until all of the layers had been deposited.
So isn't that interesting? I mean, you had all these flat layers. How did they survive any erosion over millions and hundreds of millions of years that they sat there as the surface of the earth or the surface of whatever, of the surface of the underwater sediment, or some of these are contain land animals. So they're the surface of the earth and they didn't get eroded in an uneven manner. They got eroded smoothly, if at all. And here's all these layers also in the Grand Canyon, many of them are what are called turbidites. They were deposited by underwater currents or these turbiditic flows that contain mud flows. And here's a little experiment done by Professor Veit. He has a video series as well that it's very interesting.
Here you have a typical surface of the earth with valleys and hills and what have you. And now we're covering them with water. The underground fountains shoot out. It's pouring rain from the top. Ocean water is being poured over the land, and you have these massive, catastrophic mud flows. Let's see what happens. I'm going to create an earthquake over there. See it shaking? And the mud is going to start flowing under the water from the high ground, over hills, over valleys. There goes. You see that? There goes. Over the top. It actually goes over the tops and into the valleys and covers everything. And then the mud settles out. And you will see that it fills up the valley and smoothly covers the top. Now that is soft mud, yes or no? All right. Now what if there's an earthquake over there and there's an upheaval and boom, another one comes along and flows over this one. And see what that would do. Would it mix it all up, churn it all up? What would happen? Well, let's see. Let's do it. Here we go. Another one. Boom! There it goes. Can you see that it's swirling in the front there? Okay. Now, if it's swirling and flowing over the top, do you think it's possible that there where it's flowing quite fast, that it could whip a little bit of the bottom into the top, yes or no? Okay. But then they would both have to be soft, right? Okay. Let's watch. There comes another one. Boom! Notice the swirling. Over the top. Settle down. This is great stuff. Watch it. Settles down. And what do we got? Three distinct layers. And the valleys are being filled in. That's exactly what you find in the geological column. The bottom areas, the valleys are filled in, and then they get flatter and flatter and flatter. And these are actually, by comparison here, huge on a scale, mountains. So now we can see that the next ones will just gently flow over the top. There they go. Boom. And the next one. Boom. And we're going to go a bit closer after the last one comes. And these are all soft layers of mud that are forming. Now we're going to zoom in a little bit, go a little bit closer. Let's just stop it there. What do you see? Flat layers with what type of contact between them? Flat. Surprisingly little mixing. Do you agree? You would expect more mixing. Very little mixing. What else? Let's check it out. Here we go. Let's go a little bit closer and zoom in on some of these rock formations. Now these are soft mud. There we go. Let me just stop it over there. Now it's hard to see, but if you look at this layer over here, you'll see that the heavier stuff, the pebbles, are lying at the bottom, and the softer, lighter mud is on the top. So they're graded, coarse to fine.
So that's very interesting. Which is the model? What model does the Grand Canyon match the best? Very ancient deposition with long exposed surfaces for millions of years, or a catastrophic model of deposition that's rapid and relatively, or at least relative to each of the layers, recent?
Here you have a bottom layer and a top layer, and some of the bottom is whipped into the top. Or here you have a top layer pushing into the bottom layer and compressing it. So they must have both been mud when it formed. Look at that. I call this slide the geologist's nightmare. Here you have a layer of rock and a layer of rock on top, and look at that. Can you see the total mixing here? And the bottom layer has been whipped into the top. What does that tell you about the two layers? That they were both soft and that they formed catastrophically. Now you have a load cast, there's the bottom one being pushed down and the top one pushing into it, and they were soft. Look at that. That's the Alps, folded. Look at this one. This is in Africa. Absolute folding of the rock.
So how do you do that slowly over millions and millions of years of time? If a millions of years, it should have turned to stone already. It shouldn't be whipped up as soft mud gets whipped up into overlying layers, or have these load-bearing casts push down themselves into solid rock. The speed of erosion is also very interesting. It's much too high. C.R. Twindale recognized this problem as far back as 1976. In the American Journal of Science, he writes, "Even if it is accepted that the estimates of the contemporary rate of degradation of land surfaces are several orders too high to provide accurate yardsticks of erosion in the geologic past, there has surely been ample time for the very ancient features preserved in the present landscapes to have been eradicated several times over. The survival of these paleoforms is in some degree an embarrassment to all of the commonly accepted models of landscape development." In other words, we have sedimentary layers on top of the Rocky Mountains. I go around arguing with people. I ask them, why is the sedimentary layer still there? And they're like, oh, erosion rates are no problem, because as you wash off the surfaces of these rocks, the continents themselves are lighter than the underlying magma, and they float. They float up, so you remove stuff from the top, then they float up and make up the difference, so you move more and they come up, and so you got this buoyancy, and so that's why the continents never get eroded down to sea level. Because at current erosion rates, it only takes 10 million years to erode all the continents of the world down to sea level. So that's fine, okay, the continents float, but my question is, why are the sedimentary layers still on top? If you have a dirty plate, and you start washing off the grime and whatever on top of the plate, and then you keep lifting up the plate, what do you have left after a while? Just plate, right? You should just have granite left. You should have no sedimentary layers left after 10 million years if your whole explanation is that the continents float. So my question is, why are very old sediments that are tens and hundreds of millions years old still on top of the continents after 10 million years? It just doesn't make any sense. And it doesn't make sense to Tyndall as well. They can't explain it. The Rockies, just to show you some numbers here, the Rockies are currently being uplifted at between 100 and 1,000 centimeters per 1,000 years, yet there's no change in elevation. So what does that tell you? You got this mountain that's being pushed up, but it's not getting taller. It tells you that it's being eroded at what rate? 100 to 1,000 centimeters per 1,000 years, right? So the erosion rate is matching the uplift rate. The current uplift is thought to have begun 70 million years ago. Okay? An erosion rate of 100 centimeters per 1,000 years equals 1,000 meters of erosion per million years, or an incredible 70,000 meters of erosion in 70 million years. So the total thickness of the layers in the Rocky Mountain regions is only 3,500 meters. That was the original thickness, the original total thickness. So why is it still there, if after 70 million years you should have somewhere around 70,000 meters of erosion? You should have none of that sediment left. if that's truly that old. Mount Everest has the same problem. Mount Everest is thought to be about 50 million years old. It was once covered with 6,000 meters of sediment. Now it's only covered with 3,000 meters of sediment. The Himalayan erosion rate right now is 200 centimeters per 1,000 years. 100 centimeters per 1,000 years of erosion equals about 50,000 vertical meters of erosion in 50 million years. Yet the Mount Everest is still covered by the Ordovician limestone, which is about halfway down the column. So what happened? Perhaps the layers used to be much thicker, but we know that's not true. This scientist, Hirotaka Saki, suggests that half of Everest slid off 20 million years ago. So that explains half of the erosion, because if half of it slid off, it wasn't eroded away, it just kind of slid down. So that's still 20 million years of erosion of the current Ordovician layer, and it's still there. How did it survive at the current elevation, the current exposure to erosion factors, for 20 million years? That should be 3,000 meters of erosion. Actually, not 3,000. It should be 25,000 meters of erosion. And yet we still have the 3,000 meters still there. Today's continents average 0.87 kilometers above sea level. The total land surface area of the Earth is about 150 million square kilometers. A cubic kilometer above sea level, the total cubic kilometers above sea level is 130 million. The average of several references suggests about 13.6 cubic kilometers of solid material are carried by all rivers of the Earth into the oceans every year. That's about 31,000 million metric tons per year. Time needed to erode all that land away above sea level is about 9.5 million years. So again, why is it still there if the Earth is really hundreds of millions of years old? Dott and Batten, 1971, they write, North America is being denuded at a rate that could level it in 10 million years. Or to put it another way, at the same rate, 10 North Americas could have been totally eroded since the Middle Cretaceous time 100 million years ago. And so why is it still here? Sparks, 1986, Geomorphology. Some of these rates of erosion are obviously staggering. The Yellow River could peneplain or flatten out an area with the average height of Mount Everest in 10 million years. The student has two courses open to him: to accept long extrapolation of short-term denudation or erosion figures and doubt the reality of erosion surfaces, or accept the erosion surfaces and be skeptical about the validity of long extrapolation of present erosion rates. In other words, they just don't go together. Which one are you going to accept? Are you going to accept current extrapolation of erosion rates, which can be orders of magnitude off and the evolutionary theory is still wrong? Or are you going to accept evolutionary theory and doubt current erosion rates? And if you do that, how do you explain how erosion could have been orders of magnitude less in the past over the course of hundreds of millions of years compared to today? Why is erosion rate today so much greater than it was reasonably in the past? Well, one argument is that humans came along and we do all this irrigation and we erode topsoil much more rapidly than it would otherwise have been eroded. The argument here is humans have simultaneously increased the sediment transport by global rivers through soil erosion by about a max of 2.3 billion metric tons per year, which compared to 30-something isn't that much. It reduced the flux of sediment reaching the world's coasts by 1.4 billion metric tons because of retention within reservoirs. In other words, even though we increase the erosion rate for surface soil, we also build dams. And so the total result of human impact is actually a reduction in the decline of the continental surfaces towards sea level because of this reservoir building that we tend to do. So, you know, there's still a quandary there. How do you explain both at the same time? And also, let's see, the overall smoothness to me is just a mystery. Back to the smooth dome here. This right here is a picture of that. See how smooth it is? And these layers over here are the Grand Staircase that used to cover these layers here. This is the Kaibab limestone that used to be covered by all these Grand Staircase layers over there. So how did it get, all these layers got eroded away so flatly? How did that happen slowly? Over millions of years, rain and snow and ice and everything How did it do that so like a sheet, like that, so flatly? Here's a little close to where I live. Here's a little river here, and here's some erosion. You can see how sharp the erosion is, and the nice flat layer on top. How did that happen? Did it happen slowly or rapidly, do you think? Well, that's a little trickier. That's Sigrid, my wife. So it happened very rapidly. This is at the beach in Trinidad where we live. And notice the little mini grand staircase here? See, so what happened is that the water was once on top, right? And then as it ate down, it kind of receded. There was less water, and it moved away from here. But these grand staircase levels are flat as well. They're not dendritic. They don't have erosion coming from this direction and making them kind of rounded, as you would expect over a long period of time. This is very rapid sheet erosion, obviously. So what does the grand staircase look more like? Rapid sheet erosion or slow erosion over millions and millions of years? Also, see this little red butte right there? How did it survive? Everything else, all the sediment around it, all the layers, because this layer used to go all the way over, and yet it survived all by its little lonesome self. What happened? Did it not rain on the red butte? Did it not, no sun shone on it, no ice or snow? It just sat there all by itself, resistant to erosion. And here's red butte. Right? See, all the dirt all the way around it is gone. It's all by its little self, and everything around it's gone. How did that happen? Same thing with Beartooth Butte. Here's Beartooth Butte. It's on top of Precambrian granite rock, and these layers match these layers here. They're the same as the Mesozoic layers. Notice that these layers are warped. So what happened is that the Precambrian got pushed up by tectonic motion. The continents crashed into each other, and the pressure pushed up this rock. And all the layers around Beartooth Butte, they got washed away, and somehow Beartooth Butte survived all by itself. And it didn't get eroded away. Why not? If this really happened, if this uplift really happened over millions of years, how did Beartooth Butte survive all by its little self? Now, I'm going to present a model to you, and you see which one you think it makes more sense. My suggestion is that this happened extremely rapidly. Right after the flood, there's a tremendous amount of energy that developed the flood and caused gigantic tidal waves action that deposited all these layers very rapidly and flatly. Ellen White says that the pre-flood world did not have the great mountains that we see today. These are developed because of the energy released by the flood and the continental drift that built these mountains extremely rapidly, in my model anyway. And so we get a sudden uplift that happens within decades, maybe, or maybe even less than maybe a few years. This is very rapid. All the water from the flood rapidly runs off, and it erodes very rapidly in sheet erosion. All the sediment around it, like we saw in the little beach model, took all the sediment with it, and before it could get Beartooth Butte, what happened to the water? Gone. No more water left, and it deposited. And see, as this thing warped up, these things were still soft. They are still mud, and that's why the solid rock warped like this very easily. I mean, it seems more consistent anyway that as this was uplifted, it would drag soft sediment and mud up with it and warp it. And then as the water ran off with other sediment, all this muddy water that's eroded all this stuff, then it would create the Cenozoic layers, which are still flat because they weren't uplifted very rapidly. They weren't. This had stopped its uplift by the time these were deposited by the muddy water running off from here. Which model makes more sense? The long age model of slow occurrences where this thing is just very resistant to erosion, or a catastrophic model where the water is gone before it can get that thing? Here's Beartooth Butte. You can see all the stuff around it's gone. Here's another interesting find. These are sinkholes in the Kaibab. You know that top layer around the Grand Canyon? All these little sinkholes all around it. How do you get sinkholes today? What's a modern comparison to develop sinkholes today? Well, here's the beach, these little sinkholes in the beach, the Trinidad sand. So as the water was going over the top, then the water went underneath of it and undermined the sediment underneath, and then there were weak because it's still soft and muddy, and the sediment just kind of caved out from underneath. That's how sinkholes develop today. And here's sinkholes by the Jordan River or because of the diversion of the Jordan River by the Dead Sea, these sinkholes are developing because the water level has now receded lower, and it's undermining the underlying sediments and creating these sinkholes. So does this happen slowly or while it's still muddy? Were these sediments already rock? Did they have millions of years of time to turn into rock? Or did water recede before this thing could turn to rock while it was still mud and soft? Blind End Canyons. See this little canyon, the sharp, very almost cookie cutter pattern here? And here's the start of the canyon right here, and it's very sharply defined. Was this thing formed rapidly or slowly over millions of years? If it was formed slowly by slow levels of erosion, wouldn't you expect it to be rounded off and dendritic in look? And wouldn't you expect whatever river created this to kind of undercut it in a random sort of manner? But no, it's crisp cookie cutter pattern. It's like sheet erosion went and cut this thing out very rapidly. Here's the dry falls. See the Blind End Canyon from the Google Maps, you know? See these Blind End Canyons? We know that this was produced, in the early 1920s, Harlan Bretz, J. Harlan Bretz. He presented a theory that these scablins in Washington State were produced by massive floods. And everybody laughed at him for 80 years until they finally found the source of the flood, which was a gigantic lake that had been blocked by an ice dam. And the ice dam had been undermined several times, releasing the entire contents of this massive lake in a 600 to 800 foot wall of water, and it had carved out the scablands of Washington State, including these dry falls, which are three times bigger than Niagara Falls. And they're Blind End Canyons. And he won the Penrose Medal in the 1980s because of this. But people laughed at him for a long time because they thought that if they accepted this, that they would be forced to believe in Noah's flood. But when they found that it was a local flood, then it's fine. As long as it's a massive local flood, you're good to go. But it can't be Noah's flood, no way. But let's look at the Grand Canyon. See this? You think this is the Grand Canyon from space? No, this is the Grand Canyon. See that little line? But notice this here. You know what this is? This is the Grand Staircase around it that has been eroded away. And this little river comes down through it. Here's a blow up. See, here's the tip of this. See the Grand Staircase? This is the Grand Canyon. What's this then? The Grandeur Canyon? You know? So how did that all get eroded away? And then this is called the Grand Canyon. Somebody's not looking at a big picture here. So let's look at, see this little V shape? Does that look like a Blind End Canyon on a massive scale? To me it does. You see the Blind End right there, just like the Dry Falls? And look at these lines right here. To me, see that little sharp line here? To me, this was probably a huge lake bed before, and then it broke through right here. And then all this sheet of water went rushing over here, and it created a giant waterfall right here, along this wall here. And then as the water receded, it wore back this Blind End Canyon, and before it could get farther back, all the water was gone. Right? And then all you have left with is this river. The Colorado River is still going. And soft sediment, it cuts it down very rapidly. Notice how at the beginning of the river, it's straight. It doesn't have very many gooseneck curves or anything. It's kind of a straight shot. Because rapid flowing water goes straight, and then as the energy is used up, it starts turning. See that it gets more jagged and back and forth on you as it goes farther along. And so is this more of a catastrophic model or a long 5 million year period of development? Lava dams. One of my professors at Loma Linda, he believes in evolution, long periods of time, and he kept bringing me to his office to talk about why I didn't believe in evolution all the time. So finally, I just got frustrated, and I was like, look, what is your number one reason for why you believe the Earth is old, or the geologic column is old? Number one reason. And he said, the number one reason why I believe the Earth is old is because of the lava dams in the Grand Canyon. He says, these lava dams came and poured into the Grand Canyon and filled it up, 2,000-foot walls of dam, backed up the river into these massive lakes behind it. And he says, these dams would require, you know, tens of thousands of years each to erode away, and there's lots of them in the Grand Canyon. And so how do you explain that? I mean, 100,000 years possibly for some of the larger ones to erode. How in the world can you explain how the Grand Canyon can be young and catastrophic when you have these lava dams there that would take thousands and thousands of years each to erode. And so I was like, ooh, that's a tough one. So I'll go look into it and I'll get back to you. So I was like, where should I go read up on Grand Canyon stuff? So I was like, University of Arizona. So that same week I went to the University of Arizona library, and that same month they had published a paper called Grand Canyon, the Geologic Infant. And it turns out that these lava dams collapsed within 80 minutes. They didn't erode away over long periods of time. They were undermined because when you take hot lava and you put it into cold water, what does it turn into? Glass. It turns into glass. And so how stable do you think a glass dam is going to be? You get a little bit of earthquake there, what happens to your glass lava dam? You know, and you got your 2,000-foot wall of water behind it. What's that 2,000-foot wall of water going to do to the canyon? It's going to carve it out very rapidly. You got massive amounts of water released suddenly. Remember the scablands of Washington State? You got that kind of water in a concentrated canyon. Whoosh, it's going to carve it out very rapidly. So Ed Stiles, is the geologic canyon a geologic infant? University of Arizona News, 2,000-foot lava dams collapse within 80 minutes. Huge wall of water suddenly released 37 times the flow of the largest flood of the Mississippi River. Huge amounts of rapidly moving water equal huge amounts of rapid erosion. The portion of the Grand Canyon once thought to be up to 70 million years old, then lowered to 5 million years old, quotes, may be as young as 600,000 years old. That's an order of magnitude difference. There's a range of error there between 10 and 100-fold. Initial dating of 5 million years backed up by potassium-argon radiometric dating. How reliable is that now that we got down to 600,000 years? Then we got a more recent paper published in 2007, and they've got all these different spikes of probability down to 100,000 years. So how reliable is all this? If you can range from 70 million down to 100,000 years with your range of error, how accurate can you be? All you got to go is another order of magnitude and you've got it. Mather Gorge and Holtwood Gorge, same sort of situation. They used to be dated at 180 million years by potassium argon. Then in July of 2004, Luke Russer, a geologist from the University of Vermont in Burlington, used beryllium-10 that builds up in quartz to redate these things. And his estimates came down to 13,000 years old. What's the difference between a 180 million year date and 13,000 years? I mean, what does that tell you about different dating methods agree? You hear that all the time, right? Do they really? All dating methods really agree? That's a difference of four orders of magnitude. So I went back to my professor with this stuff. And I was like, hey, your lava dams collapse within 80 minutes. And he didn't want to talk about it. Monument Valley, a big problem, same sort of situation. See these monuments? Notice that they're horizontally layered. All this sediment in between used to be connected. See these really skinny ones? Same sort of deal. What happened to all the dirt in between? And why weren't these monuments taken away? Were they all resistant to erosion too? Oh, it doesn't rain here. Everywhere else, not here. Notice also that they're lined up. See, they line up with each other in a flow pattern, current of flow. See how they're all lined up? Boom, 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 boom. Right? How did this thing know that that thing should survive and then this next one should survive all in a line? Does that happen over millions of years? That it doesn't rain or snow or anything or wind blow in this line? Right? See, here you can see it from a higher vantage point. See that they're kind of all lined up. See these long lines and stuff? These are like flow patterns.
A Danga is a rapid washout after a rainstorm. And look what you see. This whole area over here is a rapid erosion after a rainstorm. And there you have a little hill, and there you have another little hill, and flat area in between, and another one, and another one, and another one. Does it look like Monument Valley in a small scale, yes or no? Now just up the scale. Make it a massive flood, and you can explain what you can see. Here's a little donga as well. There you can see it. Rapid washout, and it's V-shaped. So it happened quickly. There's another one. As those are happening in just one or two rainstorms, there they are, and it happens rapidly. You don't need millions of years.
Convincing? I think it's much more convincing than all these things got eroded away over millions and millions of years.
All right. I'm going to take you to one of the most fascinating places on this planet. This is what is called Stadtsaal, town hall. And the reason why they call it town hall is because the whole mountain is standing on pillars. A whole mountain standing on pillars. Unbelievable. You can see right through the bottom of the mountain over there. Can you see that? Let me take it a little bit closer. Look at that. Isn't that magnificent? The whole mountain is standing on pillars. You can walk underneath it, you can walk through it, and you can marvel and say, now, how did this come into existence? How come the mountain is standing on pillars? Here you have also one of these cracks in the ground that forms after a rapid rainstorm. In that same area where the mountain is standing on pillars, you have this. Look at this rock. There it stands, a huge boulder standing on a narrow neck. And everything else in between is gone. Now let me give you a scenario. Here you have this mountain forming, and the floodwaters cover the earth. And the water rushes off the mountain slope, and the water gets shallower. And it rushes past this rock over here. And as the water lowers and rushes faster and faster, it washes out the bottom. But before the whole thing collapses, the water is what? God.
Makes sense, or does the whole millions of years of erosion make more sense? So here we got Stadtsaal on miniature again at the beach. This beach was incredible. See all the little undermining things with all the pillars? This is rapid. This is not slow. See all the little potholes too on top? So rapidly or slowly, this delicate little arch somehow survived millions of years of slow erosion. Or was it just rapid and all the water was gone before it collapsed? See that thing? And by the way, it collapsed recently. So here's a nice little skinny one here. This is the standard story about how these arches developed. More than 2,000 arches are located within 70,000 acres of southeastern Utah. They were once buried by almost 1 mile of sediment. Local uplift caused cracks to form. See, they caused little cracks to form. And they got bigger cracks because of erosion, bigger and bigger cracks, slowly eroded them into these nice little thin fins. And then the water kind of ate through the cracks and made these little delicate little arches. That's the standard story. Do you believe that? Or do you believe water just kind of went through this rapidly and cut through this rapidly before it could collapse that arch? Or do you think that thing happened slowly? See how delicate that is? These thin fins. Do you think all this sediment in between here got taken away slowly while these little thin fins stood that tall and that sharp for millions of years? How about this? This is in the middle of a huge valley. See that? Doesn't that look like Walter Veit's little rock that stood there all by itself? Stood there all by itself, everything around it for a huge valley got eroded away, and that thing survived for millions of years of erosion. No, come on. This is a river, a massive sheet erosion, catastrophic. Paraconformities, another huge problem. Here's the red wall limestone, and this is the Cambrian mauve, the white stuff underneath. See, the red stuff is interdigitated with the white stuff. They finger in amongst each other. One layer overlaps, and then white, and then red, and the white. See, here's a blow-up of it. Yet, these layers are supposedly separated in time by 200 million years. In other words, there's a gap. This got leveled down. Then there's a gap in time of 200 million years where this is still flat, no up and down erosion somehow. But 200 million years happened in between the top of this and the bottom of this. Yet, how did they get interdigitated like that over 200 million years of time when there's this gap? You know, is that catastrophic or what? Here we got the red wall in the schematic diagram, Mississippian layer. Those layers are not there. They're just missing. They got eroded away flatly somehow. There's this gap where there's no sediment. 200 million years worth of sediment gone. The Cambrian's moved up right underneath flatly. no million, hundreds of millions of years or whatever. Is this catastrophic erosion or millions of years of erosion? Newell, 1984 issue of Princeton University Press, made a very interesting and what I think is a revealing comment concerning this paraconformity problem. A puzzling characteristic of the erathrum boundaries, or the little lines between the layers, and of many other major biostratigraphic boundaries, boundaries between different types of fossil groups, is the general lack of physical evidence of subaerial exposure. Traces of deep leaching, scouring, channeling, and residual gravels tend to be lacking, even where the underlying rocks are cherty and soft, limestones. These boundaries are paraconformities that are usually identifiable only by paleontological or fossil evidence. In other words, it's not based on the physical structure of the rock, it's based on what kind of fossils are in the rock. That's the only way they can tell that there was this gap. They can't tell anything about erosion, in other words. In an earlier paper, Newell remarked, a remarkable aspect of paraconformities in limestone sequences is general lack of evidence of leaching of the undersurface, residual sods and karst surfaces, or irregular erosion channels that might be expected to result from long subaerial exposure are lacking or unrecognizable. The origin of paraconformities is uncertain, and I certainly do not have a simple solution to this problem. Well, that is, if you don't believe in a catastrophic model, you don't. This is also, you see all these angles here? This is called an angular unconformity, because there's angled rock, and then it got shaved off flat, and more rock got put on this direction. How do you do that slowly? You just shave it off flatly, and then you put on layers on top this way. Is that catastrophic or what? Clastic dikes. These are rocks that from underlying levels that squirted up into overlying rock, and then the overlying rock got eroded away. How do you squirt solid rock? See, here you got Jurassic layers, Cretaceous layers, Triassic layers. Notice that these are all millions and tens of millions of years of time, supposedly, and yet we got layers, rock from here squirted up into overlying rock, squirt, and here's like a sand layer or a clay layer in the middle of a sand layer, and the clay got squirted up in the middle of the sand a layer, and it squirts. So let me pose a scenario to you. Let's say all these layers got layered down rapidly, and they were still soft and muddy and kind of oozy, and you got tons and tons of pressure from the overlying layers put on soft, muddy layers underneath. What is tons and tons of pressure going to do to mud? It's going to find a tiny little defect in the overlying level, and all of a sudden, like toothpaste, right? Up into the overlying level, and then if it happens to be harder and this gets eroded away, it's going to stick out, it's more resistant to erosion, and they're going to make these little spikes, like this, these clastic dikes. Is that more consistent with millions and millions of years of production? Does rock squirt like that? No. Varves. In lake beds and whatnot that are supposed to be hundreds of thousands of years old, I don't know if you can make this out very well in the projection, but you can see these layers, right? Each of these layers is supposed to represent a year of time. Another layer, like tree rings, get laid down in the bottom of the lake bed every year. So my question is, see this leaf? It goes through about 10 layers here. How did it survive flapping around there 10 years? So you got bunches of here you got layers that are folded over each other. How does that happen if each of these is deposited 1 year at a time, that you get a folding over effect like this if this is not a more rapid deposition process? Lambert and Sue, somebody else will probably pronounce that differently, measured varves in Lake Wallensee in Switzerland and found up to 5 lamina deposited during 1 year. From 1811, which was a clear marking point because they knew that the canal was newly built in that year, until 1971, a period of 160 years, they found the number of lamina ranged between 300 and 360 instead of the expected one per year, or 160. So our investigation supported de Greer's first contention that sediment-laden floodwaters could generate turbidity underflows and deposit varves rapidly. But it threw doubt on his second interpretation that varves or varve-like sediments are necessarily annual. So the argument that hundreds of thousands of varves represent hundreds of thousands of years is now overturned, especially given the premise of a catastrophic scenario. Continental drift. The continents obviously fit together like a jigsaw puzzle, especially if you look at like continents like Africa and South America. See, they kind of fit together, right? If you go to a globe, you could kind of push them together and see that they sort of fit pretty good. See down here, they kind of seem little projection sticks into that indention. Pretty good arguments for continental drift. The question is, or the argument is anyway, that this continental drift happened over 200 million years of time. The original continent of Pangaea, where they were all connected, existed 200 million years ago, and then they split apart at that time, and they went their separate ways. So let's look a little bit at that scenario, if that makes sense. 2,000 years ago, Ephesus was a seaport city. Now it is 5 miles inland because of the deposition of two tiny little rivers there. Louisiana, the Louisiana coastline is being lost at 25 square miles per year because of erosion. The U.S. spends $500 million to prevent erosion on the east and west coasts. Florida spends $8 million a year alone to prevent erosion. In the past 50 years, Washington State has lost over 300 meters of certain of its coastlines. And northern and central regions of California erode at about 30 centimeters per year, with some areas in the Capitola region eroding up to 1.5 meters per year. Here's close to where I live, Trinidad Beach again. See, the erosion has gone back pretty far, obviously from the coastlines. Texas is losing between 0.3 and 15 meters of coastline per year. Major Gulf Coast storms can cause 30 to 40 meters of erosion in one day. The landmark lighthouse in Cape Hatteras in North Carolina, it was originally built 1,500 meters inland in 1869, and it had to be moved another 1,000 meters to avoid collapse into the ocean, which equals about 10 meters per year of erosion. So this is true all over the world. Japan, you know, that tiny little sliver of an island, it's spending billions of dollars to prevent erosion there. Obviously, you don't want to lose what you got. So let me ask a question. What would an average of just 1 centimeter of coastal erosion or deposition do to the shape of the continents in 200 million years? 1 centimeter doesn't sound like much, relatively speaking, right? Yet the change would be significant. It would be 2,000 kilometers or 1,200 miles, enough to erode or deposit halfway through the United States on all sides. This is not talking about the surface. This is talking about the edges of erosion. So why does the puzzle still fit? If it really is a 200 million years of split since the continents divided, why does it still fit? The Gulf of Mexico alone should be completely filled in by the deposit from the Mississippi River in 10 million years. So why is it still the Gulf of Mexico?
Paleocurrents.
Before we get into this, paleocurrents are very interesting. They are patterns of rock that show the direction of flow over very large areas, continental and even worldwide. And this is fairly recent research, hasn't been completely published. It's being worked on right now by Arthur Chadwick. And you can see more detailed videos on Amazing Discoveries, and also from the Walter Veit series.
Paleocurrents as tools. Now, what are paleo? This is fascinating stuff. Paleocurrents are flow directions derived from features of sedimentary rock that reveal the direction or sense of the current of wind or water that deposited the sediment. All sedimentary rocks contain paleocurrent indicators, some which can be read and interpreted. So now if you go and look at the various layers of rock, some of it is exposed because the top layer is cracked off, and you can see in which way did the water flow over this layer of rock. If science says that each one of those layers was once the surface of the earth, let's have a look at the individual all over the world and see in which way the water flowed supposedly during that time. That would be interesting. So what have we done? The results are there of some million measurements in the database. That's pretty much. Now, if you have a continent has basins. And a continent has areas where water flows in a particular direction towards the ocean. So in the United States of America, for example, there are these basins, and the water will flow from all the directions into the basins. Plus, there will be flow directions out towards the ocean. And that is a typical modern scenario. So, if we have a look at the general appearance today, here on the one side, the water will be flowing, generally speaking, towards the coast. There will be basins in the center, basins where water flows from all directions into the basins, and then you'll have flow directions to the oceans, etc., on the other sides. And then you can have, between all of them, you can have rivers flowing towards the oceans. That's a typical modern world. And that's what any world should have looked like if the conditions were roughly similar in the past. Is that correct? Okay. Do we have that? The answer is no. If we go to the Paleozoic, that's at the bottom, the lowest layer, we find this very interesting phenomenon. Instead of having basins, there are none. From all the measurements that have been made, it appears that the water flowed in this direction. In other words, generally speaking, from the one side here, from the east coast, generally to the southwest, right across the continent. If you go to the next layer, the Mesozoic, what do you find? Total reverse. Suddenly, things are going in the opposite direction. If you look at the somewhat higher layers, the tertiary, we seem to find somewhat different patterns, some going this way, some going that way, some going this way. So there seems to be some form of restoration taking place, a little bit higher. We seem to have some going this way, some going that way, others going that way, and still higher, we seem to have some reversals. So, what do we find? Summary. Precambrian. North America paleocurrents are variable across the craton, show no distinctive continent-wide bed. So, right down at the bottom, it's the same as what you would expect today. And maybe the Precambrian was once the surface of the Earth. That's consistent. The Paleozoic, suddenly you show patterns that are continent-wide and typically flow towards the west and southwest across the continent. That's impossible. You cannot have water flowing from one side of the United States all the way across to the other side and Canada and everything else. And then in the next time, all the way in the opposite direction. And the Mesozoic, exactly the opposite. It goes from the west to the east, and then in the Cenozoic there seems to be some continued pattern of the Cretaceous Paleozoic, but become variable, so they start becoming normal again. So what happened here in the Paleozoic and Mesozoic is inexplicable. These trends are not expected in the standard model of geology. The trends reveal processes that were much larger than anything that you see today, and they are consistent with the global flood. Let's go to South America. What would you expect in the Precambrian and in the Paleozoic? Precambrian, you have basins, you have all these strange things, not many measurements around. If you go a little bit higher, suddenly, boom, the water flowed right across the continent. Can it do that today? No. What happens here today? What's there? A huge mountain range. There's no way that the water can flow from one side right across to the other side, exactly as in North America. Wow! Water flowed right across North and South America in one direction in the Paleozoic. And in the Mesozoic, exactly in the opposite direction. Is this possible? No. Only with the universal flood would this be possible. If you come up higher, then you start getting variability again, as you would expect. So in summary, if you read it through, exactly the same pattern as you have in North America. This is unbelievable. If you put all the continents together, you have a universal pattern. So the sediments seem to have come here from the center, and the flow directions were universal. So this is an amazing story, which seems to tell us that there was
a universal flood after all.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, the way I think about it is, if you're in a bathtub and you go sloshing around, the little waves that you make, what makes them stop going? Huh? They have to run into something, right? Otherwise, if there were no great mountains, which direction would the great tidal waves or the huge tsunamis that are 2,000, 3,000 feet tall, which direction would they keep going once they started? They would just keep going, right? Whoosh, whoosh, around and around the world. And every time a tsunami went by, what would happen to the tide after it? There would be no more water there for a little while. It would give it a little chance for whatever survived to run around and make little footprints on the sediment for a little while until it got the next tsunami. It goes around the globe. It takes a little few hours to get, or maybe 12 hours or so to get around the globe. And then whoosh, wipes it out again. And pretty soon, fewer and fewer things survive to make little footprints. And we'll talk a little bit about the footprint evidence versus body evidence in the fossil record on the next lecture this afternoon. Any other questions for today? That's the geologic column. Yes? The question is, other than catastrophic arguments, are there any other factors that could account for selective erosion? And that's why I present it. For me, it's very, very difficult to imagine how you could be so selective, especially Monument Valley. How can you be so selective for erosion differentials on something like Monument Valley, or something where you got a big rock sticking out in the middle of nowhere with a skinny little neck on it? I don't know how you could be that selective. That's why I think it's a good argument.
Different densities, different materials.
That's the standard argument, is that the surface on top was hard, and then erosion kind of was able to erode partly through the harder surface, which was resistant, and then it undermined things that were softer underneath more rapidly, and then things collapsed. But on such a massive scale, where something is so isolated, surrounded by gigantic valleys all the way around, I don't see how that argument is so convincing, because if you imagine something eroding away a channel through a hard layer and then getting down softer, you would think that whatever got through first, the V that got down through first, it would keep eroding in an uneven pattern down below. It wouldn't make a smooth surface unless you had another hard layer. But even what got down first would start have a preferential treatment on the lower layers to make differential erosion before those areas that were more protected over long periods of time, before those got eroded away, you would still have a differential pattern. And we just don't see that. It's just too flat for those differential arguments, I think, to be convincing. Yes, sir?
Do creations have a certain timeline of how long it took the continent to break apart and go to their selected areas?
To get to where they are now?
Yes, sir.
The question is, do creationists have a timeline about how fast it took the continents to split apart? My personal timeline, I don't know about other creationists, geologists, but it's less than 4,000 or 5,000 years is my personal timeline. I think about it as two cars crashing into each other. You've got two automobiles traveling very rapidly. They have a head-on collision. They wrinkle the hood. How fast does it take to wrinkle the hood? Whoosh, right? And as they progress in their impact, the hoods, they build up pressure, their energy is released, and the cars start moving less and less rapidly toward each other. And right now I think we're seeing the end of the remnants of the collision. The continents have collided very rapidly with each other. They built gigantic mountains and ocean trenches very rapidly, but now they're starting to move less rapidly because they used up a lot of energy in the collision, just like two cars. And so this is the end of the collision. They're still moving. They're still jostling around. We still have earthquakes, but not nearly anything like an original collision. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, the question is having to do with the zoology and creationism. Different animals that are given similar genus or species names, how can you explain that from a creationist viewpoint? And arguments along those lines have been used to say not all species could have been preserved on Noah's Ark. There's just too many of them, millions and millions of species. Noah could not have fit all these animals onto the Ark. Therefore, the whole Ark story is a nice little children's fable. From a creationist perspective, though, I think unlike some creationists, that a lot of animals are actually descended from one starter kind of animal. That's why I like the biblical use of the word kind instead of species. For example, dogs. I think all dogs descended from a wolf-like creature, from the Chihuahua to the Great Dane. All dogs can breed and produce viable and fertile offspring. Then you have differences like horses and donkeys and zebras and all those kinds of creatures. I think those all descended from one kind of creature. Horses, donkeys, zebras. And then you say, well, horses and donkeys, those are clearly two separate species. But they can produce viable offspring, the mule. But the mule is sterile. But do you know why the mule is sterile? The reason why the mule is sterile is because the horse chromosome, one of the horse chromosome versus the donkey chromosome is inverted. There's an inversion in the chromosome, and so when they pair up, they can produce a viable offspring, because to produce reproduction, you rely on mitosis. Okay, mitotic activity doesn't matter how the chromosomes are related to each other. So you can produce a viable offspring. But when the mule tries to make gametes, viable gametes, it has to go through a process called meiosis. And in order to go through meiosis, you have to pair the chromosomes up exactly. One spot on one chromosome has to compare up to the identical spot on the other chromosome exactly. And in order to do that, when you have an inversion of chromosomes, you have to make a loop to get them to match up. And when you make the loop, then you got these translocations that occur, and they're not even because the loop messes them all up. And so you can't make viable gametes. And so the mule is sterile almost always. And so it's not necessarily that the mule has different kind of information. It's not a different kind of gene pool. It's just a physical orientation of chromosome differences. So I explain it creation-wise that different kinds of animals are created de novo originally. But when you go beyond the kind boundary, and I'll talk about that on my last lecture on genetics, how do you define what a kind is. Once you go beyond the boundary of Mendelian genetics, Darwinian evolution doesn't work anymore. Yes, sir.
When you say rapid erosion, what you call it?
Yeah, rapid erosion.
How rapid are you saying, because the way that the Bible describes the Great Flood was only 190 days.
Right. A lot of people imagine the flood as a year-long event. You know, the water came up, the water went down, and Noah got out, and it was all fine. Right? I don't imagine the flood like that. To me, I think of it as a series of closely spaced catastrophes that are massive and shortly spaced. I think that perhaps multiple meteor events, you can see meteors in Arizona. The third of the Gulf of Mexico is in a meteor impact crater. The Yucatan is right at the edge of it. It's massive. You can see these massive meteor impacts all over the place. So imagine that the Earth went through a hail of meteor impacts. What would that do to tidal wave action and oceans? And Ellen White says that the flood was so horrible the devil feared for his life, and that the ark would have been destroyed if God hadn't physically preserved it, actually sent his angels to take care of it. This was not just a simple little water comes up, water goes down. This was massive tsunamis, 2,000, 3,000 feet tall, traveling at supersonic speeds around the entire globe. It was one catastrophe after another. And then after Noah did get off the ark, was that the end of the catastrophes? No. You got these massive lakes that are released all the time. You got ice ages. You've got huge catastrophic events that also deposit layers. So I don't think of the geologic column in a simplistic, oh, this is just one event type scenario. I think of it as multiple shortly spaced events. Yeah, I usually don't get into that because people have very different views. The question is, couldn't the Earth as a physical structure have been here before life, before God, you know, started dividing things and creating life on this planet in the creation week? Could the planet have been here before that? Some people think that the whole universe was created in 6 days because in the creation week it talks about the stars and the sun and moon on day four, right? He made the stars also. But to me, it sounds like, I'll just tell you my view, that the Earth as a physical structure and the universe, stars and whatnot, could easily have been here for millions or billions of years before, because several passages in the Bible, I think, indicate that. For example, in Job it says that at the creation of the Earth, the sons of God sang together. Where did the sons of God live? Who were the sons of God? The angels, right? The angels or beings on other created planets, which Ellen White says she went and visited. There's these other created worlds with tall individuals and small individuals and whatnot. They're not necessarily people, but they're intelligent beings that lived on other planets before we were created. We were created as a spectacle to the universe. And so I think all these beings lived on other planets and other solar systems, and that the universe was here before we got here. And the physical planet of the Earth itself, it kind of indicates it in the first passage of Genesis. It says, "And the Spirit hovered over the surfaces of the deep, and the earth was without form and void." So it seems to me that it was something here. It was like a watery planet, but it wasn't formed. It hadn't been formed. The waters hadn't been divided. It hadn't been given structure. It hadn't been made into a place that could support life. And so I believe that the physical material of the planet could have been here, and most likely was here, before creation week. So I argue the evidence for young life, not necessarily young Earth. So I call myself a young life creationist instead of a young Earth creationist.
In that vein, how do you explain day four then in terms
of... Oh yeah, I forgot to... The day four where it says, "And he made the stars also, the sun and moon and stars." I think about it as a perspective problem. Who wrote Genesis? Moses, we believe, right? Ellen White says it. If as an Adventist, we believe Moses wrote Genesis. I believe Moses was given a vision of creation week from an earthbound perspective. So if you're in vision and you're stuck on the earth, on the surface of the earth, and you're looking at the vision of what God is doing to the planet, what are you going to see? When you first see, in the first day there was light, right? But there was no sun. You just see light, right? And that's before the firmament got separated. It would be like sitting on the surface of Venus or something, where you got a very dense atmosphere, like you're looking through a very fuzzy glass. All you can see is light. You can't see the sun. You can't see the stars. And then when God divides the firmament, the atmosphere above and the waters below, then it becomes clear, more clear as like crystalline material. And you can see through it. All of a sudden you can say, aha! There's the sun, there's the moon, there's these stars. And so I think it's more of a perspective issue, that Moses said, aha, all of a sudden these heavenly bodies appear. But I think that's part of a perspective process of God actually creating other things that reveal the sun and the moon and the stars. And also it's kind of like a tangential point. He kind of offhandedly throws out, oh, by the way, God made the stars also. It seems almost offhanded, like it's not necessarily that it was made during that week, if that makes sense. Well, thank you all for coming. This afternoon will be fossils and theology.
This media was produced by Audioverse for GYC, Generation of Youth for Christ. If you would like to learn more about GYC, please visit www.gycweb.org. Or if you would like to listen to more free online sermons, please visit www.audioverse.org.